Welcome to Ukraine and Beyond and to my collaboration history series, Ukraine History in the Making. Over the next 4 months, Yevgenia Fedotova.
History is one of the maybe most interesting subjects in the school curriculum.
Olena Dudko.
Without knowing your past, you cannot build your future.
Elisabeth Polvas.
I think that it is of the urgent importance to the world hear us and the world hear how devastating is the Putin's war.
And I will present the history of Ukraine as it was, as it is, and as it hopefully will be. Now, let's get to the episode. Enjoy. Welcome to the fourth episode of Ukraine History in the Making. Once again, we have Elisabeth Polvas with us. And for those who maybe haven't heard your episode yet, can you share your background and stuff like that?
Hello again and again for initiating and hosting this important podcast. It's very important now to talk about the true history of Ukraine as it's been under misinformation and false narratives from Russian side especially, and for general understanding of the European audience. My background is in international communications. I have a master's degree in that, as well as experience in the Office of the President of Ukraine and Ministry for Foreign Affairs of Ukraine.
Great to hear. And yeah, as said, this is our fourth episode, and this means that by now we are quite deep into the story of what is Ukraine's history. And therefore, I think it's fair to say that we can now sort of draw a starting conclusion somehow. Obviously, it's not going to be a, oh, this was then how the Ukrainian history was conclusion, because you can never do that. But just a sort of general thought about what is Ukrainian history and what does these three episodes and periods that we have so far covered, like what does they say about Ukraine? And for this point, I know that you actually prepared some thoughts and some things you wanted to say. So maybe I can just start by asking you, Elisabeth, fourth episode, we've done three now. What is like your general thoughts concerning Ukrainian history, relating it to the things we have talked about?
Yeah, so far we've embarked on an exploration, diving into three pivotal episodes, ancient Ukraine, Kiev and Rus, and the Mongol invasion and rule. In those episodes we saw reoccurring patterns, a lot of common topics and themes, influential actors that have shaped Ukrainian history. And the main topic here would be always the resilience and sustainability of Ukrainian history, from the resilience of ancient civilizations to the golden age of Kiev and Rus, and the challenges of Mongolian invasion. We've witnessed the ebb and flow of power, culture, and identity on the lands of Ukraine.
So it's fair to say that from your perspective, already now we have explored a lot of different histories as well within the history of early Ukraine, and we already see now the like huge dynamism within the story of Ukraine. Can you share some more words on that?
Absolutely. Resilience under the oppression, the colonization, and as we see today, we've been under different colonial powers, not only Russian, but Polish influence, Lithuanian influence. But as we delve deeper into the topic of today, we will see how differently those rules looked and how much more freedom and flourishness, for example, the Polish and Lithuanian influence brought to the territories of Ukraine.
Yeah, sure. And of course, today we are also going to talk about exactly that, which is mainly the Lithuanian influence, because today we're going to talk about the Grand Duchy of Lithuania and its influence on Ukraine with the expansion that that state entity made in the, yeah, that is then the 14th century and possibly 15th century as well. You're gonna delve much deeper into that. One of my general thoughts so far, which is also very much related to what you were talking about, is just how dynamic Ukrainian history is if you compare it to, for example, Danish history. And I've made this comparison a lot of times, but we started with ancient Ukraine, and then we took like from the 500 and then up until like the 11th century. And then after that, we moved our way into the 12th century with the Mongolian invasion. And this is just already so many actors contributing to the development in Ukrainian history. And that is one of the themes I would like to talk about. Yeah, so we also do this where we talk a bit about one of our themes in the beginning. And for me, it really... these three episodes have just showed how many actors and how many different like influences there are on Ukrainian history. And for me, this also, if to talk a bit about one of the themes, it goes to show really how abstract a concept like geography actually is, because geography is like suggestive of something that was always there. So that could be like a territory, a hill, a mountain, or something like that. But when you then put the history of people into that context of said like geographic locations, you really see just how much the movement of people, of empires, of different state entities, of cultural development, like the flourishment of Christendom, for example. And I think Ukraine is just such a melting pot for all these developments. And this just for me goes to show that Ukraine, the geography, like the territory that Ukraine covers and did historically with Kievan Rus, there has just been going on so many things on what is actually a rather small territory if you compare it to like the rest of the world. And I just think that's very telling. And this is why I think it's so important to bring this geography perspective in as well. Do you want to share a few thoughts down the same line here, or do you have anything else?
Yeah, definitely. The first thing that I would love to share is that, yeah, you're absolutely right that geographical aspect played a pivotal role here. I mean, in terms of how many influences and actors were involved into becoming of a Ukrainian state, and if I may make a little change to what you said, it's not a small territory. It's a really, really vast, especially in terms of horizontally land, which is currently the biggest state in Europe, basically. So we're talking about quite a big part of land, and of course a lot of things happen there. But also Ukraine is on a kind of crosswalk between Europe and Asia, and we were always between the big players like Poland, Lithuania, subsequently Russia. So no wonder that we had all those influences. However, we can, like nation is not only about the geographical borders, it's about the national identity, the culture, the language, and we can see the consistency here, and we can see how, despite all those influences, the language, the tradition, the national identity, the national idea survived on Ukrainian territory. And that's why we have a country, and that's why we are fighting for this country, because it's been a long, long history of resilience and try to preserve what we believe in and what is important for us as a nation.
And before we move on to like the concrete subjects of today, can you maybe shed some light on why geography plays such an integral role in the like mind of Ukrainians concerning what is the Ukrainian state, because contrary to a lot of other countries, the flag of Ukraine is actually in itself a resemblance of Ukrainian soil and like Ukrainian geography. So can you maybe this is maybe a good time to put that in into some words.
Yeah, of course. Ukraine resembles the fields of wheat and the blue skies above them, as we are really famous for our fruitful soils, as well as resources inside the in-ground resources. So of course, that also was an aspect of interest from different big actors throughout our history. It's not only the agricultural lands and fossil fuels that are inside of the ground, but also forests and gold and amber and some other more specified resources. Yeah, it's not hard to be desirable, let me say so. I just wanted to say that today we will be talking about the historical aspect of Ukrainian history between 1385 and 1430, because the Lithuanian rule ended in the mid-15th century with subsequent territorial reconfigurations and shifts in power dynamics in the region, while Lithuanian influence persisted in some Ukrainian territories. Beyond this point, the late 15th century marked the beginning of a period of transition, as other powers such as Poland and the emerging Russian state asserted themselves in the region. By the late 15th century, the political landscape of Ukraine had undergone significant changes, signaling the end of direct rule of the Grand Duchy of Lithuania on Ukrainian territories. So it's just the framework, time framework for today's episode.
And thanks a lot for that. Just one last point. I want to reiterate what you said about the fact that ground in Ukraine, or the soil in Ukraine, is so good for like grain production, for example. It is really something. Additionally to the geographic placement between those great powers, then it is something that really has put the lands of Ukraine into the minds of so many different leaders throughout world history, especially in the later centuries like the 20th and 19th century. So this idea that a lot of people have probably heard about Ukraine as being the breadbasket of Europe, I would say that that is possibly correct, at least to a certain degree. But you need to treat that saying with the sensibility that what it actually stems from is different wishes from dictatorial leaders or something like that, who wanted to come in and take control of Ukrainian land. And that is actually where this saying stems from. At least that's what I think. And so I just think people have to treat that with the sensibility of where it comes from. Do you have a comment to that as well?
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. Moreover, Ukraine is currently, at least was before the full-scale invasion 2022, the first world importer of wheats, of some crops designed for animals to feed on, as well as sunflower seed and sunflower oil and corn, and the number one of export in chicken. What does that mean? It means not only the benefits from international export, but also the problems related to this. For example, one of the reasons that our integration in the European Union, and I'm not saying the main reason, but one of the important reason why our integration in the European Union is so challenging, because integration into European Union means also the integration in the market. And as we know, Europe has special for agricultural products as well. And Ukraine, the agricultural power as it is, would be a huge challenge for European productors. So it always all benefits comes with a dark side in this life.
Yeah. And this is also the reason why the price of, for example, like frozen pizzas went up after Russia invaded Ukraine in 2022. And on a more serious note, this is also the reason why we see this sad possibility of a lot of hunger in some of the African countries, because they lay right beneath Ukraine, like beneath Ukraine in the Black Sea and the Mediterranean. And a lot of the export routes of grain to these countries goes from Ukraine and then via the sea to these countries, for example, Somalia, I think. And people just have to be aware of the fact that this also means that by initiating this full-scale invasion, Russia is then also causing a possible hunger crisis in these African countries. And this also goes back to Ukrainians' style as being very like good for food production. And yeah, this kind of turning into a deep dive into Ukrainian agriculture, which is kind of nice. But I think because it is just so important both today and historically. But I think now we should transition to like the concrete historical storytelling. And I will begin by kind of rounding off last week's episode. No, not last, but a few weeks ago we had the last episode. And I will begin by rounding off that. So last time I talked about the Mongolian invasion, and then we subsequently talked a bit about Mongolian rule over Ukrainian lands. But I think that we brushed it off maybe a bit too quick. So now I will just very shortly walk through what I have read and what I can see was the case. So basically what the situation was after 1241 was that the Mongolians then came in and ruled what is Ukraine today. And the way they did that was that, so first of all, you have to be aware that like the grand force controlling these territories, these Ukrainian territories, were the Golden Horde, which is probably the most famous of the Mongolian hordes back in the days. And this Golden Horde was then electing different leaders for different territorial marked areas. So basically what you can imagine, like to give an example, today you have different regions in Ukraine. What the Mongolians did, and of course you cannot draw lines directly, but what they was that they, in kind of the same way that Ukraine is organized today, they split the country into different regions, and they put like local yokes those places. So you had the Tatar yoke was like a branch sort of the Golden Horde, which was the yoke that controlled all of Ukraine. So basically after 1241, the Tatar yoke controls Ukraine. They split Ukraine up into different regions, and then they place a leader within each region, and then they kind of apply a set amount of people for that leader, and also an amount of land. And then what they basically did was they said to the leaders, all right, you now have each of your own little society. And interestingly enough, there wasn't any commerce between these different societies. So the way that the Mongolians structured it was very much to create self-sufficient entities, and then they controlled those entities with different leaders. And obviously I very much dislike the Mongolian influence on Ukraine, and especially the way that they took over Kiev, but it is said that these conditions actually created some good, like how can you say it, conditions for the flourishment of life and of like recreation of life and so on. So at least you can maybe say that the structure itself was not the worst thing about the Mongolians. But yeah, and did you have something to comment here?
Yeah, When we talk about Mongolian rule, it's very important to also talk about modern Russia, because what modern Russia is the edge of a Mongolian influence. Basically, the way they approach politics, social structures, even now, it's quite a Central Asian way in this sense. I mean, it has a lot of roots in Mongolian rule and the Tartaria, the Tartar that was there on their territories. So to understand Russia better, we should go deep into Mongolian rule. And we should understand that Russia is more of an Asian product than a European product. European influence, as it is known now, and Russia as it is known now, started only with Peter the Great in 17th century. Before that, the main like grounds for building the social and political structures were quite Central Asian.
Actually, I think in the end, I have a quite interesting little side story that also kind of sheds some light on like Russia and their way of doing things. Actually, in the period I will talk about, it will be the Moscow Principality or Principality of Moscow. But yeah, I'll get to it. Let me just quickly brush off here. So the Mongols have these entities, and then when you read about it and see like different videos about it on YouTube and so on, what I actually sense is that what happens is not so much that the Mongolians just loses a big defeat or something in a battle. That also kind of happens, but it just seems as if the Mongolians are getting more and more disinterested in Ukraine and in ruling over the Ukrainian lands. And also a lot of other things happen in the Mongolian Empire, another theme we will talk about again and again. There is a succession crisis in the Mongolian Empire, so the sons of Ogedei Khan, who was the Khan when they conquered Ukraine, he dies. Then his son starts to fight, and the Golden Horde and Ukraine is so far away from the epicenter of the Mongolian Empire. So that obviously kind of just fragments like the control that was over Ukrainian lands and fragmented. And this just leaves the Mongolian Empire very weakened in that area. So like the Golden Horde and the Tatar yoke kind of fragments. And then what happens is that in a battle in, so this is 120 years after the Mongolians conquered Kiev, in a battle in, I think, 1361, the Grand Duchy of Lithuania defeats the Mongol Empire, and then yeah, Ukrainian lands are out of Mongolian control for like ever since, and comes into the hands of the Grand Duchy of Lithuania. And you will of course talk more about that, I think. I just want to mention one very funny thing that I like, funny, interesting, you can call it what you want, but because the Principality of Moscow exists all this way under Mongolian influence. And the story is kind of the same there, that the Mongolians gets more and more disinterested and more disintegrated. This paves the way for Moscow to rise and to gain more and more autonomy, serenity, and so on. And at some point, they are actually in such a state that they can claim complete autonomy over Moscow. But, and here is the very interesting thing, what actually happens is that we still have a Khan. In theory, we still have a Khan of the Golden Horde in the area that was Kievan Rus. But this Khan, he kind of loses his grip on power in the area. He also loses his respect and so on among the other Mongolian tribes. And also he loses respect for Grand Lithuania. Maybe people have to check up on this detail, because I'm not quite sure about the alignments here. But I think that he is actually, I think he is, yeah, he, the one, the Khan that loses respect is the one that is also allied, I think, with the Grand Duchy of Lithuania. What then happens, and this is where you see modern Russian tactics come into play. What happens is that Russia then makes an ally with someone who is also a Mongolian, but who is contending the, in theory, Great Khan. So I told you that he lost his respect and so on. This means that a contender arises to be the next Khan. And what Russia then does is that they ally themselves with the contender to the one who was the Khan in theory, stroking some kind of deal where they agree with the Mongolians, okay, if we help you take him out and then attack the Grand Duchy of Lithuania, then we will make some sort of territorial agreement afterwards. And lo and behold, what Russia, of course, then does is that they don't live up to their responsibility within the agreement that they made with the people who supported the contender to the Khan position. And this very much makes me think of what they did with Ukraine as well, when they said to Ukraine, all right, we will ally with you guys, and we will get to this as well, because this is in a war against Poland. But what they also said to Ukraine was, all right, we ally with you, and then we take down Poland. They did that, Russia and Ukraine, but then Russia didn't keep its promise about Ukrainian sovereignty. And I think maybe this was also something they learned all the way back then, once again also talking into the perspective of Russia not stemming from European values, European ideas about state creation, but that they much more comes out of this very by power dominated logics and deception and everything counts and so on. So I just think that a little side story is interesting. People need to look into it themselves if they want to have the know about the concrete historical facts, but just be aware that this is a Russian tactic and it started all the way from the beginning, because this was the beginning of the Russian state. And I think that's actually my kind of roundup of the last episode, and I know you have some things to say here as well.
Yeah, definitely. I would like to say that if we look closer to Russian actions and how they do not keep the word, exactly as you said, there would be no wonder that they created this full, they made this full-scale invasion in 2022. For anyone who was following deeply Russian side and Russian politics for the at least past 50 years, they could see that the grounds for this invasion started long ago. And again, as you said, if we trace it deeper into history, we can see the consistency in their actions and kind of like a political strategy or political character that they have of not taking promises.
It's like the origin story. You fake up an alliance, you tell you will do something that you will not live up to, then you carry out the plans that you initially agreed on, and then once the third power is erased from the equation, you go in and then you take all the power that you otherwise decided that you should share with the other entity that you were fighting with. And yeah, this just works on so many levels, actually. Yeah, sorry, I kind of interrupted you there, but it is the origin story of Russia. And that's, they will probably never accept that, but that is actually how it is. And I really think people should look this stuff up, although it's pretty nerdy. And like, you have to be pretty deep into it to realize these things. But I was just watching this video and then I just saw the stars fall in line. And like, I had this feeling, you know, oh fuck, shit. This was actually something they did all the way from the beginning. So that's just interesting. Do you want to go on now talking about Grand Duchy of Lithuania and like all this emergence into Ukraine and so on?
And that Ukraine is an ancient independent nation. Ukraine has a history of more than 1,000 years. Kyiv was a major metropolis and cultural center when Moscow was not even a village.
Yeah, absolutely. So the let's talk about the beginning of this impact and the cultural exchange between Lithuania and Ukraine that happened during this time. So the Grand Dania was a multicultural and multi-ethnic state, encompassing not only Lithuanians and Ukrainians, but also Belarusians, Poles, Jews, and many other ethnicities. This diversity fostered a rich cultural exchange with Ukrainians, contributing to the intellectual, artistic, and religious life of the Grand Duchy. Additionally, the Lithuanian ruling elite adopted many elements of Ukrainian culture, including language, customs, traditions, and further strengthening the ties between the two regions. And here it's very important to mention that we can see that the ruling power can have different approaches towards the lands and ethnicities and nations that they take over, because when we will in the future talk about Ukrainian life under Russian rule, we would see that Ukrainian language was constantly oppressed, prohibited on the state level, you know, level. It was seen as threat, while when we see Europeans having influence over Ukrainian lands, you can see that they actually adopted a lot of Ukrainian traditions, words, cultural aspects, and merged that inside of their culture, creating new cultural opportunities. And that's how cultural exchange should look like. That's what the diversifies cultural appropriation or the genocide, which Russia conducts now and was conducting throughout past 300 years towards Ukrainians. Yeah, vice the other rules of Europeans that we had over our territories.
Yeah, so it's safe to say that when looking back, Ukrainians have much better things to say about the rule that was the Lithuanian and Polish rule over Ukrainian lands compared to that of Russia. Can you maybe just put, what is your thoughts about how this historical difference between Russian rule and Polish and Lithuanian rule over Ukraine, like, how do you think that difference segments itself into the minds of Ukrainians today? And obviously, you have the full-scale invasion now and everything, so obviously everyone hates Russia for very good reasons. But maybe excluding that fact, can you share some light on this difference and what it makes in the minds of Ukrainians?
Certainly. Again, talking about language, Ukrainian language recently prohibited on the state level in Russian Empire, for example, and in Soviet Union subsequently. Okay, in Soviet Union it was not directly prohibited, but it was definitely marginalized, and the good work was done there. Even I myself was the victim, or let me say, to take all the responsibility on myself. I was under this influence as well. For example, I had a boyfriend of 5 years whom I loved a lot, but his parents, they spoke Ukrainian. And imagine that, I was speaking in principle Russian with them because I'm the third generation of Kievan citizen. I come from intellectuals, and I will speak Russian language because it is the language of intellectuals, and Ukrainian language is just for rural areas and only uneducated Ukrainian. And me realizing that after the full-scale invasion, when I switched completely to Ukrainian and did huge internal job on teaching myself to even think in Ukrainian, when I'm thinking Russian now, I stop myself and say to myself, no, tell it again, like tell it to yourself again in Ukrainian. So it's a big, it caused a huge internal conflicts inside of minds of many Ukrainians, but here it's very important to trace the history back and understand why I thought that Russian is the language of intellectuals. Not because it's the fact, just because that was the result of a continuous and very coherent narrated Russian propaganda throughout, again, plus 300 years. We're not talking only about the Soviet Union times. And I think it's very important for each Ukrainian to do similar job to what I did and reflect on ourselves, admit where we were wrong, admit to ourselves. I even called the family of my ex-boyfriend and told them that I'm very sorry for because I was acting this way and that I understand it now. Yes, it took me this much time. Yes, sadly, I needed to see Russian bombs in the sky as I saw when I was in Kyiv to realize that, but better late than never.
Thanks so much for sharing this personal reflection as well. This sounds like a thing that must have taken quite a toll on you as well. Like, this is something that goes very near to the identity, I guess, of a person, and especially for Ukrainians, like this language thing. We could obviously delve much deeper into that as well, because this is also a reoccurring theme when I have talked with Ukrainians, like the transition from Russian to Ukrainian. But you explained perfectly well why it was that Russian was like the language intellectuals spoke. If I should put it very briefly, it was because of the Soviet occupation or Russian occupation of Ukraine in the 20th century, and there they made Russian the official state language, thereby making it so that if you wanted to develop deeper, higher into like intellectual society, you had to speak Russian. That was the only possibility. Do you have a comment to that?
Two remarks here. As an example, my mother is almost 60 years old, so her youth and the period of her education happened in the 80s, which is important to mention. And she was the teacher of Ukrainian, Russian, and Russian literature and language, just because the teachers of Ukrainian language had smaller salaries on a governmental level inside Soviet Union, Ukrainian language was not even the one that was
prioritized and
needed in school. The ones you could skip. How does it go? Not comprehensive.
I think what you're looking for is that Ukrainian kids going to school had to learn Russian, but they could skip learning Ukrainian because learning Russian is necessary for you to function in the society, because the Russian occupation for so many years made it so, right? Like, that's the thing about...
And the second remark here, that it's very important again to mention that it happened not only during Soviet rule, but when Russian Empire existed, Ukrainian language was prohibited officially on many levels. For example, by Emsky directive, the directive of M, and we will touch upon it in the future when we will talk about this period. Yeah.
I actually think
to the point that even the notes, the subtitles for the musical notes were prohibited in Ukrainian. So Ukrainian composers could not even expand the aria or any opera thing and write the subtitles in Ukrainian. It was prohibited.
The more I learn about Ukrainian history, the more clear it just becomes to me how brutal an aggressor and occupier Russia actually has been in Ukraine. Because, and we will get back to this, obviously, but we have spent quite a lot of time talking a bit in circles about today's period. But I actually think this will be clear as well when we delve deeper into it. But you actually see that every time a national identity, a national language, customs, and so on start emerging in Ukraine, that is whenever Russia then goes in and make these very restrictive laws on Ukrainian language. So yeah, it's just this actually where we could talk so much about it, but I think now let's get to the main subject of get back to the main subject of today, because you were talking so much about the cultural influences, the cultural sharing and all that stuff, and how people intertwine. But one thing I want to ask about, because I know it's very important, is the Union of Krevo. So can you maybe tell us about the Union of Krevo and its significance?
Certainly, Emil. The Union of Krevo was signed in 1385 and marked a pivotal moment in the history of Great Duchy of Lithuania and its relationship with Ukraine. This union established a dynastic link between Lithuania and Poland through the marriage of Grand Duke Jogaila of Lithuania to Queen Jadwiga of Poland. As part of this union, Jogaila agreed to convert to Christianity, and we can also trace it all back to the Vladimir the Great, who baptized Rus and established Christianity in the region. Talking about the consistency and continuity of Ukraine history. And this union had profound implications for Ukraine, as it is as it brought the region closer to the sphere of Polish influence and set the stage for future political developments and further the ties between Ukrainian and the rest of European civilization.
And do you think it's fair to say that the Union of Krevo was what really, how can I say it, that really segmented the relation between Ukraine and Lithuania and Poland and so on? Is that a important step in the history of relations between, that's the Union of Krevo, it marks a significant point in that story? Is that a correct assessment?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And moving forward to Jagiellonian dynasty and other topics, we would see the continuation
Let's just talk about let's just talk a bit about the Jagiellonian dynasty. Yeah, sorry for the pronunciation. Why does it have to be Ukraine that I'm so interested in? It's worst regions for language for me. Which is kind of funny, since the Scandinavian forefathers and stuff like that. But yeah, anyways, Lisa, let's get back on track here. How did the
Jagiellonian is a Polish word, and there is now a very famous and well-known in Ukraine, Jagiellonian Institute, which is located in Poland, but a lot of Ukrainian, and we have a lot of academic interactions with this university. Never mind.
All right. Now I need to get to the question. So, Lisa, how did the Jagiellonian dynasty further shape the relationship between Lithuania, Poland, and Ukraine?
Yeah, the Jagiellonian dynasty, founded by Jogaila and Jadwiga's descendants, continued to govern both Lithuania and Poland. Under the Jagiellonians, the Union of Lublin was established in 1586, creating the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. A federal state further integrated the territories of modern-day Ukraine into the Polish-Lithuanian sphere. This period witnessed a flourishing of Ukrainian culture, with the city of Lviv becoming the major center of intellectual and artistic activity. And once again, we see that Ukrainian culture under the Polish-Lithuanian rule had a space to grow and flourish. And exactly at this period, Lviv established itself as the artistic and intellectual center hub of this region.
And going a bit further in the exploration of this period, because you've talked a lot about the intertwinement and the good relationship, I guess you can say, if you look at it overarchingly, but even though you have this situation, you still see some tensions arising between Ukraine and the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, which culminates in the Cossack uprising. So can you tell us about that?
Certainly. The Cossack uprising, particularly the Khmelnytsky uprising of 1648-1654, was a pivotal moment in Ukrainian history. And why does it happen? Because Ukrainians have always been independent. And even though our culture flourished and had a possibility to grow under the Polish-Lithuanian rule, we wanted more sovereignty and integrity for ourselves. Fueled by the protests against Polish-Lithuanian rule, exactly because of the reasons I just explained, particularly regarding social and religious freedoms, because again, Polish and Lithuanians are Catholic, we are Orthodox, and the Cossacks, led by Hetman Bogdan Khmelnytsky, one of the most important figures of Ukrainian history, rose up against the overlords. This uprising ultimately led to the establishment of an independent Cossack state known as Hetmanate and marked the beginning of the decade of the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth's influence in Ukraine.
So here we actually see the creation of independent Ukraine, sort of, you can say, which is the Hetmanate state.
Definitely. Moreover, we see one of the first examples of democracy ever recorded on the planet Earth. Way before the US Constitution, there was a constitution of Cossacks filed and signed by the representatives of back then Hetmanate. And Hetmanate was kind of a democratic state because Hetman was elected openly through the either like raising a hand up on the general elections with all the Cossacks presented. Yes, it was only the man who could vote, but still the level of democracy, incredible for 16th century.
Do you think, Lisa, because I know also that the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth and maybe also like the Grand Duchy of Lithuania had also democratic procedures or democratic compared to other systems within its time, like procedures also, they like in the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, I also know that they had elections for different positions of power. Do you think, again, what is at play here is this influence and like sharing of ideas so that the Hetman and state, before that was formed, saw the kind of democracy, in inverted commas, they had in Poland, and then they could use some of that knowledge also to form their own kind of system. Do you think there is an like interplay there, or is it more of a solo Ukrainian project, if you know what I mean?
Yeah, I guess it's hard to objectively say what was the first egg or chicken, but my opinion is that it's the intertwined process, and of course Cossacks learned from the experience of other European influences and powers at the time. But I want to stress here that this democratic way of being is a very Ukrainian thing, rooted deep into our identity and political interactions. We've always been following this democratic way of being. If, again, we are talking about 16th, 17th century, like international relations as we see them now existed back then. But again, Ukrainians didn't choose the king for themselves. They chose a hetman, and hetman was an elected actor. So it was, there was no monarchy in this sense. So I would suggest that it's more democratic that of a structure that we see, for example, in Poland or Lithuania at the time, because still they were monarchies, maybe not absolute monarchies, but monarchies. But Yeah, expanding here a bit, I think it's a good time to touch upon political influence of the Grand Duchy of Lithuania, and it's played a pivotal role in political development of Ukraine, fostered ties between Ukrainian territories and broader European context. The Union of Krajowa and subsequent agreements with Poland paved the way for closer political integration, leading to the establishment of the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. This political union provided Ukraine with a greater autonomy and representation within European affairs. Additionally, Lithuanian rulers supported the growth of Ukrainian administrative institutions, contributing to the consolidation of a statehold in the region. So, yeah, we can say in some sense that Polish and Lithuanian rule established the ideas and the structures of a new age for Ukrainian state as we know it now.
And I think actually, because so far what we have done is mainly to like talk a bit about the most important concrete points of history concerning the relationship between Ukraine, Poland and Lithuania. So you have like the Krajowa pact, was it right? And then
Union.
You have after that the Jagiellonian the Krajowa Union, and then you have the Jagiellonian dynasty. And from the Krajowa Union and then to the Jagiellonian dynasty, there's quite a wide span of time that we haven't talked that much about. But I think what you have written about the legacy actually kind of goes into this time as well, because in order to explain the legacy and the influence, you also have to explain what happened. And you talked a bit about one of them, but you have been so nice so that before today, you have actually split it up into like different themes. So I think maybe it's just a good idea if you like take over here and then kind of walk through some of these different influences that it had. And I think you already talked a bit about some of them. So yeah, you can just like say, I already talked about this, and then move on to the next one. Because I think it's it would be very nice to hear all of those actually.
Sure. So the legacy of the Grand Duchy of Lithuania was profound and multifaced. It laid the foundation for cultural exchange, political integration, and state building in the region. The Lithuanian period contributed to the development of Ukrainian identity and left an undeniable mark on the country's history, language, and culture. As I touched upon, the political influence and cultural influence, I can elaborate a bit more on cultural aspect. The exchange that we had manifested in various aspects of Ukrainian life included language, literature, religion, and art. For example, Ukrainian literature flourished under Lithuanian patronage, with prominent writers and poets contributing to the rich tradition of the era. Additionally, religious institutions and practices were influenced by Lithuanian customs and traditions, shaping the religious landscape of Ukraine. As to an economic influence, the economic ties forged between Ukraine and the Grand Duchy of Lithuania and facilitated trade, commerce, and economic development in the region. Ukrainian cities such as Lviv and Kyiv became important centers of commerce, benefiting from strategic location within the Lithuanian realm. Moreover, Lithuanian rulers implemented policies to promote, again, agricultural and commercial activities, further stimulating economic growth and prosperity in Ukrainian territories. And here, I guess it's quite obvious, again, that under Polish and Lithuanian rules, even though we again touch upon colonizational aspect, because basically we were part of the bigger empire, we would not call it empire, but still bigger organization, and we were kind of dominion for them, but they didn't use us solely as the resource to drain the resources out. They invested money and know-how and expertise and knowledge to foster the region, and that's the logic behind any smart empire. To not only drain the dominions out of everything, but to actually promote commerce and agriculture and trade there. And we can see those examples in many, many other imperial practices over the world. Russia, on the other hand, was always known by more of a destruction approach towards its territories of influence. But talking about Grand Duchy of Lithuania, the military aspect is very important here, because Lithuania provided Ukraine with military protection and support, particularly in the face of external threats and conflicts. Lithuanian armies often defended Ukraine against intrusions from neighboring states and Normandic tribes, safeguarding the stability and security of the region. Additionally, Lithuanian military institutions and tactics influence Ukrainian military practices, contributing to the development of a capable and organized defense forces. And that's what we see in Cossacks later, because Cossacks were well-known mercenaries. They were asked, for example, I'm currently located in Vienna, and there is a park, Turk Park in Vienna, where you can see the monument dedicated to Ukrainian Cossack and its horse. Why? Because Cossacks were asked later to safeguard Vienna from Ottoman Empire. Cossacks were involved in many other conflicts, external conflicts, because they were well known by their military excellence and special tactics. And I'm not saying that it is all the results of Lithuanian and Polish influence, but definitely some grounding aspects of military mind of Ukraine were established back then. And to summarize all this up, the legacy of Grand Duchy of Lithuania is vast and enduring. From cultural and political influences to economic and military aspect, Lithuania played a crucial role in shaping both identity, history, and the development of Ukraine as a nation. The bonds forged during this period continue to resonate in contemporary Ukrainian society, underscoring the enduring importance of the Lithuanian era in the Ukrainian history. And moreover, it gets even funnier when we see how Lithuanians are portrayed in modern Russia. There is a joke which would be understandable only for Russians or people who are living under the Russian informational influence, being that Lithuanians are the reason for all the problems. If some problem occur, who is guilty? Lithuanians. They always joke about Lithuanians being the bad guys in disturbing Russian plans. And I guess that's where it all begins back then in 13th, 14th and 15th century.
Kyiv was not ruled by Moscow. They were not part of the same political entity. For centuries, Kyiv was looking westwards.
Thanks so much for this walkthrough of the relationship between Ukraine, Poland, and Lithuania. I think what is great about this is that we now kind of have covered both the Grand Duchy of Lithuania and the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, and like their influence on Ukraine and the way that Ukraine shaped and developed during their rule. And perhaps because what we could have done also is to have dwelled very deep into the Grand Duchy of Lithuania and into the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. But I think I'll just say here then that what happens is that first, you have the rise of the Lithuania, like the Grand Duchy of Lithuania, and they control Ukraine. And then at some point, you see the emergence of Polish power as well. And then what Lithuania does is that they are kind of, I guess you can say to a bit degree, that they are strong armed somehow by the rising Polish power. But then instead of having this huge war or huge conflict or something, they settle their disagreements by creating the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, which is, I think, also the point you talked about, right, with the Jagiellonian dynasty, where they made this marriage alignment. That's where the Grand Duchy of Lithuania goes from being that to the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. But I guess, given what you have said also, the impact that Poland and Lithuania have had on Ukraine are very much intertwined. So talking about Ukrainian history, it probably makes sense to take both of these entities and their like shared entity, and then to talk about that influence on Ukraine, which is what we did now. So thanks a lot for that, Lisa. It was very nice that you could step in and take the responsibility here. And then I think the next time we will talk about the rise of the Ukrainian nation, like the Cossack identity. You already touched a bit upon it, but I think this creates a perfect space for going further on that road the next time. And then we can also talk about, yeah, the said conclusion of that otherwise spark of Ukrainian identity, which of course comes when the Russians come into the picture, as it does so often. But we will talk about that the next time. So that was like the concrete historical period for today. Now I want to ask a few questions, and we are already at the hour mark, so there's no reason to make it too long, but I at least still have some time. And I think that first of all, it suits now to delve into this colonial perspective. So basically we are working now with four general perspectives or themes, patterns, whatever you want to call it, within Ukrainian history, which is the one about geography that we already covered earlier. Then it is the continuation of Ukrainian history. It is the colonial perspective, and then it is the misinformation perspective. And I think probably from this episode, the colonial perspective, for the first time, it also did during the Mongolian, but that's just so long ago and we don't know that much about it. So probably today's episode is the one where we can say something about the colonial perspective. So you already talked so much about this, different rulers, different strategies, different perception of the different rulers that have been in Ukraine among Ukrainians. But I still want to ask you, how do you think that like this period that you have covered is like explanatory, I guess you can say, for the overall history of Ukraine? So do we like see patterns here? I know you have the Polish overlords as well, controlling a lot of land as well, being very rich. You have this very much feudal system. But can you just elaborate on this whole colonial perspective, talking about it in the sense of today's subject?
Yeah, the colonial aspect here is quite obvious, being that we were under the influence of a bigger power rather than bigger power ourselves, or like independent and strong enough to, combat this rule. But here we see the example of Ukraine's being under the colonial influence from Lithuania and Poland. And our culture, our traditions, the language, the political system, the economic state, growing and flourishing nevertheless, which means that it's possible. It's just that the tactics that Russia was implying over Ukraine were the ones that led to like absolutely different state, where everything was going down rather than rising up, as we can see under the Polish-Lithuanian rule.
And obviously this will be a lot more clear when we also start talking about Russian influence. Actually, one of the things I want to mention quick here as well is the fact that, yeah, so when I was in Ukraine, a lot of people also said, yeah, this war conflict goes back 300 years. They kept emphasizing that point. And I think probably even though I already knew so much about Ukrainian history and so on, it kind of strikes me actually that in the grand scheme of things, Russia has only been ruling Ukraine for 300 years. What is just the case is that this is the most recent 300 years. But actually, when I think about it, it's not like Russia have some sort of magic place in the context of Ukrainian history. Not at all. They were just the ones who ruled over Ukraine for the most recent 300 years. There goes so much before that, that in the overall equation has a lot bigger impact, I would say, on Ukraine today and Ukrainians historically. So this Russian occupation for 300 years is maybe kind of like a very sad parenthesis in what is hopefully the future story of Ukraine. So that is very much something that I have realized now, just how short amount of time those 300 years are and how much they don't, these 300 years are not a natural thing in Ukrainian history is probably how I can sum it up. And like, this just goes to show so much that different rulers can be like, it's because when people hear colonization, you immediately think that must be bad, no matter who the colonizer were. But with your story and with what we're going to hear later, we just have it so clearly spelled out now how much of a difference it can make who is the colonizer and what is the intentions of the colonizer. And I think that's a very important point to take with you for all the listeners, that like, countries have been colonized, people have been colonized ever since world history started. And it's more the natural state, especially in earlier history, that you were colonized. So you were basically left to the devices of whoever were colonizing you. And that just is so important then, what intentions the colonizer have. And absolutely. I think that is very good, well spelled out here.
Absolutely, you are right on both ends. And talking about the first aspect, that Russia is only a part of Ukrainian history, not even the biggest part, because if we take 300 years and compare it to the whole timeline of Ukrainian history, even which we discuss here, starting from Tripilia civilization, then we see Kiev and Rus, we see Yaroslav the Wise, we see all these dynastical marriages and strategic marriages and relation of Ukrainian like king's daughters to France, to England, to Poland, to Lithuania, to Hungary as well, and many, many other, England, many, many other states, Netherlands, Denmark, as well as we can see the Polish and Lithuanian influence sooner, later, that's what we discussed today, and many, many other European ties that Ukraine had as a nation, because we are not talking about country here, we are talking about nation. And again, the very important point is that Russians are distorting the fact that we are a nation. But I think that what shows the best that we are, never, though they try to distort it and change the narrative, is that even in 14th century, under the Lithuanian influence, we still identified ourselves separately from them, because again, everything went so well under Polish and Lithuanian influence. Why didn't we just merge and decide that we are Lithuanians and Polish? Because we are not. Because we share a different language.
Can I make an objection here?
Of course.
Was also because the rulers of Lithuania and Poland accepted the fact that Ukrainians wanted to be Ukrainians. They accepted the fact that there is a Ukrainian identity that is different from the one that we have. But Russia never accepted that. And I just think this goes to show again the difference in intentions. Obviously, we're going to see also the rise of a conflict between the Cossacks and the Polish and so on. But they just accepted and admitted to a very large degree that Ukrainians formed this identity and that all these feelings arose. And that is just so, like, I think a lot of people are not aware of how important it is to, I don't even know how to say it, but like, I think a lot of people have the sense that history sort of is, then there was this power, they took control over this and this and this and this territory, then there was another power who did the same, and basically everybody just tried to do the same thing. But that is not the story of the world at all. Like, there's such a difference, and one of the most fundamental differences, I think, between different rulers over territories within world history is that some of the colonizers, some of the rulers, some of the leaders, they allowed separate nation identities to develop because they thought that this was in the interest of said people to develop this identity, and that it was also in the interest of the initial ruler, right? Because then he or her avoided a conflict that could have otherwise happened. But yeah, Russia just never worked like that.
Never. And I can even explain why. Because Lithuanian and Polish influence, and Lithuanians and Polish were absolutely certain of who they are. They had their own ideas, and like cultural and ethnic and national entity. While Russians, they're basically like all of their identities myth. And they were way more afraid of Ukrainians because we showed them what they should have been as a nation, because they don't have a national idea. They don't have the continuation of political structure, of political tendencies. That's why they were so afraid. And that's why they tried to oppress any cultural differences within the lands they acquired, because their own story was not strong enough to exist near the nations as Ukrainians or Kazakhs or any other countries that we can mention now who are still under the Russian influence.
And we're going to obviously dwell deeper into this as well, but I think that maybe a conclusion from this episode could then be that whereas Lithuanians and Poles had a strong enough identity within themselves as being Polish and Lithuanian, so that they didn't felt as threatened by the rise of Ukrainian identity. So you can sort of say the ethos of their national identity was strong enough so that they allowed another national identity to arose, because they knew already back then what a national identity means. And then you have, on the other hand, Russia, who never had a strong national identity, especially within its origin phase, and therefore they always needed to borrow and steal the national identity of the Ukrainians in order to have a national story themselves, because their own story just isn't strong enough. Yeah, I think actually, now I can like say, well put, Emil, to myself, if I could say it like that. Do you have anything to add here? about the subjects of today? Or
I think you worded it perfectly as a conclusion, and I guess our listeners today had enough information for one day. So I would love to thank to everyone who's listening to us and to everyone who's supporting Ukraine. Each voice matters. Each voice is appreciated by us. Thank you, Emil, for your interest and for your actions, which is the most important towards helping us in this important existential struggle that we have. Slava Ukraini.
Yeah, Slava Ukraini. I want to say as well, because this will be the very last thing for today, there is this saying that goes like, action speaks louder than words. I think that is a true saying, but within the context of contributing to Ukraine, I would actually reframe it and say, action speaks much louder than interest, because a lot of people are interested in the war in Ukraine, but they don't do anything. They just follow it. And if you then talk with your friends as well, stemming from your interest, then I think fair enough. But actually, if you are just like a couch analyzer watching YouTube videos and then just don't do anything besides that, then to be quite frank, you actually don't do anything that helps Ukraine, although you may think that you do that just by being interested. So action speaks much louder than interest. And because we're all interested, like almost everyone is interested if you ask them about it, but they need to make some actions. And that's also why I want to go out by once again saying, like, follow and share to get the story of Ukraine out everywhere. It's very important. That's my last words for today. Do you have anything?
Just another round of thanks, and the call to action to donate to Ukraine. If you feel like donating for military aspects is not something that you want to do, please do donate to humanitarian funds and charity organizations, one of them being the Children Heroes. It's a foundation which covers and helps children who lost one or both of their parents to this war. Each euro matters, and it can really change life of Ukrainian kids.
That was it from this week's episode. I really hope you guys enjoyed it and that you will follow along as we make our way throughout Ukrainian history. Besides that, I encourage everyone to find us on social media. There are links in the description. On social media, we will also post reels, videos, pictures, and other stuff to make all this easier to follow for you guys. And if you support our work, then why not like, follow, and share to get the story of Ukraine out everywhere. Hey, Slava Ukraini!